Hello, this is Chair Ruth Richardson, and pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the Education Policy Committee to order. I would like to remind members that meeting materials, including the agenda, are posted on the committee's website. Before we proceed with committee business today, I want to take a moment to send our condolences to the family of Jamari Rice, the 15-year-old student who was killed yesterday outside of his school. We also want to send our thoughts and prayers to the 17-year-old victim that remains in critical condition. We all want our children to be safe inside and outside of school, and I also want to acknowledge that there are no words to express the grief or the devastation of losing a child, and that it's our communal responsibility to keep our children safe. With this first roll call to confirm quorum, I would also like members to take this opportunity to share the communities that they represent as well. With that, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Richardson.
Richardson, present. I represent District 52B, and the school districts within that are ISD 196, 197, and 199. So that includes Mendota Heights, West St. Paul, Egan, Invergrove Heights, and Rosemont.
Vice Chair Hassan.
Vice Chair Hassan, present. And I represent District 62A, and I only have one school district, and that's Minneapolis School District. Thank you.
Representative Erickson.
Representative Erickson, present. I represent District 15A in rural Minnesota, and my school districts from south to north and to the east are Zimmerman, Princeton, Malacca, Onamia, Isle, Ogilvy, and Mora. And I also have students sometimes enrolled in Foley or Piers. So in East Central Minnesota, students attend a lot of different schools as far south as Elk River. Great to be here.
Representative Bennett.
Bennett here, and I represent 27A. School districts in my area are the Albert Lee School District, as well as Glenville, Alden, Blooming Prairie, and Hayfield.
Representative Berg.
Representative Berg, present. I represent Burnsville and a small slice of Northwest Lakeville, and my school districts are 196 and 191.
Representative Bowe.
Representative Greg Bowe, present. I represent 47B, that's school district 112, Chaska, Chanhassen, and Victoria.
Representative Christensen.
Shelly Christensen, I represent 39B, which is out in the St. Clair Valley area, and I represent District 834 Stillwater Schools and a very small slice of Matamita Schools.
Representative Driskowski.
President, I represent Southern Wabasha, Southern Goodhue, Northern Winona, and a small portion of Dodge County, West Concord, and Concord Township. Thank you, members.
Representative Edelson.
Present, and I represent Edina, and my schools are Edina primarily, and then I also have a sliver of Hopkins, kids that go to Hopkins Public Schools, as well as Richfield Public Schools.
Representative Feist.
Present. My district is 41B. That covers the Mounds View School District, where my children are in fourth and sixth grade, as well as the St. Anthony New Brighton School District and the Columbia Heights School District.
Representative Frazier.
Present. I cover District 45A. District 281 to Robbinsdale School District is my school district, where my kids are also students there.
Representative Jordan.
Hi, everyone. Jordan present. My name is Sydney Jordan. I represent Northeast Minneapolis and Southeast Como, and I have the honor of representing Minneapolis Public Schools.
Representative Keeler.
Keeler present. District 4A, I have Moorhead Public Schools in my district.
Representative Moeller.
Hi, everybody. Representative Moeller, District 42A, Arden Hills, Moundsview, and Shoreview. And most of my district covers the Moundsview School District with a little bit of Roseville.
Representative Mueller.
Good afternoon, everyone. Representative Patricia Mueller. I represent 27B, which is down in the Austin area. I have five different school districts in my district. I have Austin, Lyle, Leroy, Southland, Grand Meadow, and then I have a parochial school of Pacelli. And I have some students that go to Stuartville because I represent Racine. I also have some students that go to Hayfield because I represent Brownsdale. Austin School District is where I taught for the last 5 years, and I'm really excited to be back here with all of you. Thank you.
Representative Poston.
Representative Poston, present. I represent District 9A, which is Todd County, Cass County, and Wadena County. My schools are Staples Motley, Pillager, Wadena Deer Creek, and Sabika.
Representative Scott.
Representative Scott is present. I represent the cities of Andover, Coon Rapids, and a little bit of the city of Ramsey. And I represented almost all my districts in Oka Hennepin with the sliver of St. Francis.
Representative Erdahl.
Representative Dean Erdahl. I represent District 18A, directly west of Hennepin County. And my school districts are Litchfield, Hutchinson, Dassel, Cokato, Eden Valley, Watkins, and Atwater Cosmos, Grove City.
Representative Wozlowick.
Wozlowick present. I represent District 38B in the northeast suburbs. And I have the largest school district in my district is White Bear Lake. I also have parts of Matamidi, Stillwater, and Moundsview.
Madam Chair, a quorum is present.
Thank you. We'll move on to the approval of the minutes from March 17th. Representative Moeller, have you had an opportunity to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I would move the acceptance of those minutes.
Thank you, Representative Moeller. If members could unmute, all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The minutes are approved. We'll move on to the introduction of staff. We have some new staff and also some returning staff as well. And I know that, as always, we are going to be in really great hands with our amazing staff teams. In terms of new staff, I want to introduce Sydney Spreck as our committee administrator. Isabel Rose is the new CLA. Slove Beckel is the fiscal analyst, and also acknowledging our continuing staff, Christine Para, Tim Strom in nonpartisan research, Mars Beltrandi Rudquist in DFL research, and also Jody Withers, GOP research. So with that, we are going to move into today's presentation. And I don't want to take too much time with the introductions because I want to ensure that there is enough time for a full discussion following the presentation as well. But we are going to be hearing about a report that is disturbing and many levels in terms of sexual exploitation involving high school students. And today we have representatives from the University of Minnesota, from the Minnesota Department of Health. We also have some survivors who will be talking today, as well as representatives from the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. And with that, I will turn things over to the University of Minnesota to begin the presentation. I believe that we have Dr. Martin, who will be kicking us off.
Thank you, Chair Richardson, and to the whole committee. We are, we're really happy to be here to share this information, even though, as Chair Richardson mentioned, the information we're gonna share is hard to hear. So my name is Lauren Martin. I'm a professor at the University of Minnesota in the School of Nursing, and I'll be presenting with my colleague, Dr. Nick Ryder, who is a professor in the School of Medicine. Another of our colleagues is here for the Q&A, and that is Katie Johnston-Goodstar. She's in the School of Social Work. So we are part of a team at the University of Minnesota called the Minnesota Youth Sex Trading Project, or MIST for short. And really what our group at the University of Minnesota is doing, we are, we combine deep community engagement with quantitative data analysis of the Minnesota Student Survey. And we'll present here some findings from our analysis of the Minnesota Student Survey. And really our goal is we do this research because we are in support of efforts to promote well-being and prevent sex trading and sexual exploitation of young people through this data analysis and sharing. So Nick, if you'd like to share our slides, that would be great. Okay, can you all see that? I'm not seeing the, oh, there it is. Okay, awesome. So if you wanna head to the next slide. Great. So we're here to share information from, that we're deriving from this new question that was added to the Minnesota Student Survey in 2019. And that new question is, have you ever traded sex or sexual activity to receive money, food, drugs, alcohol, a place to stay, or anything else? And really the addition of this new question opens a window into the lives of our high school students to really learn more about what's happening around sex trading and other associated issues. This question was asked only of 11th and 9th graders, and it will be included, it is included on the 2022 survey. I wanna note that our colleagues from the Minnesota Department of Health in the Injury and Violence Prevention Unit really spearheaded the effort to get this question added to the Minnesota Student Survey. And this question is part of a broader epidemiological effort within Minnesota Safe Harbor and really in partnership with our team at the university to really understand and kind of get our arms around the scope and nature of this issue. As you can see here, 1.4% of students in Minnesota who completed the Minnesota Student Survey said yes, that they have traded sex. We think this is an underestimate, and Nick Ryder and I are going to really get into the data a lot more here in a second. Okay, so this is a little bit what we're going to present. I'm going to do a little bit of background. I want to, you know, explain a little more about the issue, and we want to explain about what the Minnesota Student Survey is. Then we're going to dive in and present some data from the 2019 Minnesota Student Survey. Then we'll hand it off to our colleagues from MDH. I believe they're up next after us. Okay, so a little bit of background. We're going to be sharing information about young people involved in transactional sex, meaning the exchange of sex for something of value. This can include many different experiences, so it can include what's sometimes called survival sex, exchanging sex for basic needs. It includes exploitation and of course, sex trafficking. Lots of research has shown that trading sex, exploitation, and trafficking are associated with many negative outcomes for youth. I have some of them listed here on this slide, so things like sexual risk-taking, substance use, trauma, sexually transmitted infections, homelessness and poverty, and mental health problems. I also want to note that young people who trade sex have a lot of strengths also, and assets and hopes and dreams. And we work hard, and we think it's very important to recognize that young people have lots of strengths within them to help them heal and move forward. Okay, next slide, please. So you're going to hear different terms in this presentation, and sometimes this language can be confusing. When referring to youth legislation and services typically use the term sexual exploitation and sex trafficking. But the Minnesota Student Survey uses the phrase traded sex or sexual activity. This was an important aspect to the question because a lot of youth, in fact, many or most youth don't actually identify with or even understand the terms exploitation and trafficking. Right? It's not part of their everyday lexicon, the way they talk about things. So the way the question is worded is really designed to flag the behavior. So in line with that question, our presentation, we are going to be using the phrase traded sex, but want to make sure that we're clear. We know this includes a lot of exploitation and harm as well. Okay, next slide. So identifying the prevalence of trading sex, exploitation, and trafficking is very thorny and a very difficult issue. It's very hard from a research perspective, but we need this data in order to accurately scale and direct resources. It's really critical information to help us know what we should even do in relation to this issue. Okay, next slide. This slide has a lot of sort of researchy stuff on it. The main point I want to make here is that it's hard to make a credible prevalence estimate, primarily because it's really hard to get a representative sample of young people. There's no list of high school students who've traded sex. It's dangerous, it's stigmatized, it's illegal. And many of the young people don't, like I said, you know, they don't identify with these terms. But we are very lucky in Minnesota to have the Minnesota Student Survey because one of the best ways to get an empirically grounded answer to some of these prevalence questions is to ask the survey of a general population. Then we can really get a sense of how many young people, and we can also correlate it to other questions that are in the Minnesota Student Survey. So we can really get a deep dive understanding of what's going on for youth. And now I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Ryder to share a little more about the Minnesota Student Survey.
Similar to what Dr.
Ryder, I'm sorry to interrupt, but before you begin, can you introduce yourself for the record as well so that it can be archived appropriately?
Oh, sure. I am Dr. Nick Ryder. My pronouns are they, them, and I am with the University of Minnesota Medical School. Do you need any other information?
That's perfect. Thank you. Please proceed.
So similar to what Dr. Martin has said, Minnesota has an amazing reputation for asking really important and groundbreaking questions of students, especially among historically excluded or hidden groups of young people. So in 2016, Minnesota was one of the first states in the nation to ask students about gender identity using a statewide census-style survey. And then again in 2019, Minnesota became a leader with including this question that we're talking about today about sex trading. And so what is the Minnesota Student Survey, or what we often call the MSS? So for one, it's a really great resource that we have available to us that helps with planning, that helps service providers, it helps policymakers, and of course, researchers like us. But what it really is a surveillance system that runs that's run by our state departments of education, health, human services, and public safety. And it's similar to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Youth Risk Behavior Survey. It's conducted every 3 years, and all school districts across the state are invited to participate. And the goal is to survey all 5th, 8th, 9th, and 11th graders in the participating school districts. So we end up with this really enormous sample of over 170,000 students who were in school on the day of the administration who also agreed to participate in it. And we also have resources or data available from smaller samples of youth who were in juvenile correctional facilities and also alternative learning centers. So in 2019, 81% of school districts across the state participated. So again, we have students from all around the state of Minnesota. And when we think about just the high school group of students, because that's the group that gets asked the question of, about sex trading, So if we think of the general population for high school students, the sample size was over 80,000 students who filled out the survey, and most of them did it online. So for the project that we're a part of, our secondary data analysis focuses on the high school students, so the 9th and 11th graders, who also answered that question. So our sample size ends up being just a little bit over 71,000 students. So in Minnesota, we're really fortunate to have this source of data available to us. And again, it gets administered every 3 years. So the last time it was administered was in 2019. And so now we're in 2022 and it is currently underway. The state is really invested in this public health data. And as we've said before, we are leaders in the nation for this public investment and with the data that we have. And it really does inform a lot of interventions and prevention efforts that do and can happen. And so the question about sex trading will be asked again, or is being asked in the 2022 survey. And so we're able to be able to do additional analyses and also start to look at time trends. Lauren, back to you.
Sure, thank you. Okay, so we're done with our background section now, and we're gonna just get right into sharing some of the findings. So what this slide is showing you is the percentage of students within certain groups who said yes to that question of trading sex. So what you can see here is 1.4% of students who were in a public school indicated yes. 5.4% of students in an alternative learning center indicated yes, they haven't been involved in trading sex, and 12% of students who completed the MSS while in a juvenile correctional facility said yes. So what we're showing here is these sort of different contexts and different prevalence rates of students. This helps us zero in on groups of students we may want to really focus on with supports and prevention efforts. I do want to note that these top line prevalence estimates are, we believe, underestimates for a variety of reasons. The first is that this is a sensitive question. Only students attending school on that day would have been able to complete the Minnesota Student Survey. We know that school pushout and dropout disproportionately impacts high school students who may be more likely to indicate that they have been involved in trading sex. So that means, students who trade sex may be less likely to be in schools. And then that juvenile correctional facility number, it's not consistently administered. So, there may be more going on there than what this data is showing. Okay, so this slide, we want to give you a sense of the geographic spread of people who are trading sex, young people, and also to look specifically at the prevalence in different regions. So what this slide is showing you is prevalence rates within the Minnesota Department of Health Safe Harbor Regional Navigator areas. So for example, in the Northwest region, the green region there, you can see 2.1% of the students who completed the MSS said that they had traded sex, compared to say 1.2% of students in the East Metro area. So what this figure is showing you is that students across the whole state are involved in trading sex, and that this is not necessarily just an urban issue or a metro issue. We can see across greater Minnesota, students are trading sex, and also even higher rates in northern Minnesota than what we're seeing in the metro area. So I'm going to turn it back to Dr. Ryder for the rest of the presentation.
The MSS provides us a window into what's happening with young people, and so we're going to go through some more high-level findings, and we'll get a little bit more detailed when it comes to the emotional distress or mental health concern slides that we have. But advocates and folks that have been working in this field have long been discussing the fact that boys are also involved in sex trading, and that transgender and gender diverse young people are likely to have higher rates of sex trading. And so the MSS data shows that cisgender boys and girls reported similar rates of trading sex, and that transgender young people had a much higher rate. You can see the 5.9. And young people who indicated that they were unsure about their gender identity were also reporting an elevated rate of trading sex with 3.3%. So our analysis is also revealing, which you'll see in some future slides, that cisgender girls and even more so transgender adolescents who trade sex experience much higher incidence of other harms, such as suicidal thoughts and behaviors and mental health challenges. One of the things that we also want to note is that the MSS does allow participants to indicate if they did not understand some of the questions, such as the gender identity question, and we did not include those kids in this analysis. So again, the MSS data really validates what advocates have long been saying, that, for example, American Indian and Native young people have higher rates of being exploited. So often Indigenous communities are left out of surveys, whether that's because there's low number of participants or there's statistical significance. But for this example that we have, we took steps to really make sure that we aren't excluding this really important community of young people. And so we can see here that there are higher rates among the American Indian and Native adolescents, and also among the other groups of people of color as well. And so we put this slide in just to take a quick pause to ask people to take a deep breath, but also to prepare you. So as we've been saying, some of the rates that we'll be coming to are pretty jarring or alarming. And so we like to just prepare people for that and make sure that you do what you need to take care of yourself with seeing some of the numbers, just because they can be heartbreaking. So deep breath. Okay. So the Minnesota Student Survey asked students about a variety of health indicators, including emotional distress and mental health concerns. We're going to take some time to compare different rates across anxiety as well as lifetime suicide attempts between students who traded sex and those who reported never trading sex. And we also stratified by gender identity groups. So students are asked two screening questions about generalized anxiety. And you can see the two questions word for word on the screen. What we do is we add up the scores to these two questions to come up with a cutoff, which is a score of 3 or more for whether students reported elevated scores and potentially need further assessment by a healthcare provider. So on this table, we give you an intersectional look into the impacts of elevated rates of anxiety or those who screened positive or were above that cutoff that I just talked about, sex trading, and gender. So on the far left side of the screen, you'll see that the overall rate of all 9th and 11th graders in the state of Minnesota who screened positive for elevated anxiety based on their response to those two questions on the previous slide, the rate was at 28%. And then we can see that over half, so 56% of students who trade sex screen positive for elevated anxiety, compared to only 27% of students who never traded sex. So that number just under it. So that's a pretty big difference. That's a twofold difference in the rates that we're seeing. And so now we go a little bit over to the right that adds details about gender. And what we see is that transgender students are showing that over two-thirds, so 69% of transgender students who traded sex screened positive for elevated anxiety, compared to just a little bit over a half of transgender students who never traded sex. So transgender students in general, regardless of trading sex, are reporting higher rates of anxiety, but we do see that it does increase for those who report trading sex. Now, if we look at cisgender girls and boys, we see this the same outcomes with those who traded sex, reporting higher risk for elevated anxiety compared to those who never traded sex. So specifically, 2/3 of cisgender girls who traded sex screened positive for anxiety compared to just a little over 1/3 of cisgender girls who never traded sex. And then for cisgender boys, we're seeing 40% who traded sex screen positive for anxiety compared to 16% of cisgender boys who traded sex reporting elevated anxiety. So we see that the cisgender boys are demonstrating a lower risk for anxiety, but it does, again, increase for those who trade sex. So overall, we showed it in this way so that it was a little bit easier to make some compare and contrast across the groups that we're showing. But what we see is that youth who trade sex are at much higher risk for elevated anxiety compared to their classmates or other students who never traded sex, and that transgender students, regardless of trading sex, are reporting the highest rates of anxiety, followed by cisgender girls and boys who trade sex. So now we'll move on to lifetime suicide attempts. So students are also asked the question that you see on the screen. So we combine the responses of yes in the past year and yes more than a year ago to get the rates of any lifetime suicide attempt. So this table is set up the same way as the past table that we just looked at, and it gives you an intersectional look into the impact of suicide attempts, sex trading, and gender. And what we see here is that 8% of 9th and 11th graders in the state of Minnesota have ever attempted suicide. And then we see that just under a half, so 50% of students who traded sex ever report a suicide attempt, compared to only 8% of students who never traded sex. So that's huge. That's a six-fold difference in the rates just between the general students who report trading sex versus those who report never trading sex. And then we get to students by gender identity group, and the rates that we see for transgender students who report trading sex is quite staggering. 76% of transgender young people who trade sex indicate that they've attempted suicide. And we see that the rates are elevated when we look across those who report trading sex compared to those who haven't. So again, these numbers are heartbreaking. They're jarring to see, and it really begs for action. The MSS also asked a lot of questions about health and health-related experiences. So on this slide, we wanted to show you the percentage of youth being seen by healthcare providers who also reported that they've ever traded sex. So just as an example, among youth who've ever traded sex, among youth who've ever been treated for an alcohol or drug problem, 15% reported trading sex. And then in the field, we've also been talking about how groups of young people most impacted by sexual exploitation have a range of specific experiences and are in certain contexts. And that these are the nuances that need to be taken into consideration and factors that need to be taken into consideration for people reporting higher rates of trading sex. So we want to note on this slide, this 7.7% of young people who've experienced sexual violence. And so we note this to give the additional information that those experience sexual violence, what's included in that category is sexual violence by a relative or a family member, a non-relative, a non-family member, or an intimate partner. And again, we're seeing higher rates than what you would see in the general population. But not everything is bad news. So similar to what Dr. Martin was saying earlier, we do try to look at protective factors or other factors that we can lean on to glean information about how to bolster resilience and help young people And we see that 72% of students who trade sex said that they feel safe at school. And this is something that we can build on. So these data highlight the need for maybe school-based interventions to prevent sex trading, reduce harm, and increase access to resources. Schools are a place that have a lot of resources, a lot of, you know, like we're school nurses and counselors and some of the healthcare providers that would provide some of the resources and help that we've talked about in the previous slide. So we've just laid out some very difficult data, and with some of the analyses that we're doing and some of the more deeper dive analyses that we have been doing, we do see that they're just kind of gut-wrenching numbers and they're hard to sit with. But we do think that the larger story here is that sex trading is a hidden health problem that negatively impacts the young people that have participated in the Minnesota Student Survey, and also outside of that, but that's who we have in our data set. The number of youth correlated harms and the population-wide impact warrant treatment of sex trading among youth as a public health issue. And in Minnesota, we're positioned really well to be able to address some of the concerns and issues that we're seeing here, and to be able to really think about things from an intersectional and also social determinants of health perspective, especially because Minnesota is, we have our state response of the Safe Harbor Program, and that is supported and in collaboration with the Minnesota Department of Health. We know that youth who trade sex are in our schools. And as we were saying, this is a place where we can really offer some support. And we also need to lean into the wisdom of the youth and communities with lived experience, because they do know what they need to heal, and they can tell others and adults what they need, really need to help them. And so community-engaged and participatory research is also critical. So please let us know any questions that you have. On the slide decks that are on your website, we left some resources. We also let you know who is on the research team. And if you're interested in the more community-facing, less jargony and less academic ways that we try to really inform the community, we do have this Instagram that we do want people to know about, and then our references. So that's our last slide.
Thank you, Dr. Ryder. Members, I think we will wrap up the presentation with a few other speakers we have here, and I've got a running list of members with their hands that are raised. Next up, I'd like to introduce Carolyn Palmer with the Minnesota Department of Health. Please introduce yourself for the record, and please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm just going to put this up, and all right. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I am the Safe Harbor Director. I'm located in the Violence Prevention Unit at the Minnesota Department of Health. Thank you so much to the chair and the members of committee for having us join you today for this very important conversation. I'm going to give you a bit of an overview of the Safe Harbor Program, which is Minnesota's response to the sexual exploitation of youth, and talk about how we use the MSS data in order to improve our response. So, as many of you know, the Safe Harbor Law was passed in 2011, and the main crux of that law was to ensure that youth under the age of 18 were no longer criminalized for prostitution. Instead, they were referred to services and supports that really offered them a victim-centered, trauma-informed, youth-centered, strengths-based, and culturally responsive lens. In order to implement the Safe Harbor system, there was a three-year planning period called No Wrong Door. And No Wrong Door brought together people from a variety of disciplines, child protection, law enforcement, community advocacy, prosecution, in order to plan the system that we currently have in place now. Safe Harbor went into full implementation in 2014. And it's based in the Minnesota Department of Health because we wanted to take a public health lens on this issue. And in fact, Minnesota is the only state in the country that has this type of program based in its public health department. We partner quite a bit with a variety of community and government partners, which I'll talk about a little bit more. And our focus, because we're coming from a public health lens, is really on prevention, promoting health equity, making sure that we have a holistic network response that looks at all of the potential health impacts on youth, and that we're elevating survivor voice in all of the work that we do. When the Safe Harbor Law first passed in 2011, the services were primarily focused on youth who were under the age of 18. A few years ago, the law changed, and now the service eligibility is through age 24, which is like our state's Runaway and Homeless Youth Act. So at the Minnesota Department of Health, we have our Safe Harbor Director based there, and we provide the grants to regional navigators and supportive services. We conduct a biennial evaluation of the program as required under statute. We offer training and technical assistance, and we also administer a federal grant through the Office for Victims of Crime in the United States Department of Justice, which allows us to expand our work to look at labor trafficking and exploitation as well, which often overlaps with sexual exploitation. We also partner with the Minnesota Department of Human Services, which has the Office of Economic Opportunity in charge of managing the shelter, housing, and outreach grants for Safe Harbor. And we partner extensively with child welfare and vulnerable adult system responses through DHS and across the state as well. Through the Minnesota Department of Public Safety, we work with the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension's Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force, which again operates statewide. It works with state, local, and federal law enforcement agencies. They also partner with TRUST, which is the Tribes United Against Sex Trafficking, is the law enforcement response for many of the tribal nations in response to trafficking and exploitation. And then also the Office of Justice Programs and the Department of Public Safety gives training and technical support to law enforcement. And finally, we partner with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and they offer protocol development and multidisciplinary team technical assistance across the state. And this allows communities to create their own local response to sexual exploitation of youth. You have been provided with a couple of handouts about Safe Harbor in your packet. This includes a map of the Safe Harbor system, as well as an overview of our programs. But just to give you sort of a brief rundown here, we have 11 regional navigators in the state. That includes two tribal navigators out of Mille Lacs and White Earth. We have 28 supportive services grantees, 17 grantees offering shelter, housing, and outreach. We have those two labor trafficking direct services grantees under our federal grant. And then also we partner with 9 tribal nations, and they're receiving state and federal funds. You can also note that some of the agencies receive more than one grant, so there might be an agency that has a regional navigator that also provides supportive services and a shelter and housing program. And you're going to hear from one of our regional navigators, Anne Lafreniere Ritchie, in a few minutes. In our last evaluation period, we served 1,207 unique clients across the state, and we will be submitting our evaluation report very soon. That gives a terrific overview of all of the ways our system is being used. As far as the Minnesota Student Survey goes, I really want to emphasize that because we have a public health approach, we really need to have the best available data to understand the scope of any problem. That then helps us to build our response. And in particular, because we're coming from a public health perspective, we want to look at primary prevention efforts to address that problem. So what the student survey provides us is empirical data that comes directly from students themselves. It lets us know what their real-world experiences look like. And as you saw in the presentation, it also helps us to better understand how other issues are impacting them as well, such as mental health or maybe bullying and harassment. All of the various issues that come into play that might be impacting their well-being come to us through the student survey. In our partnership with the University of Minnesota, we have the opportunity to dive very deep into the analysis of this data. And we are committed to working with the university and other partners in order to continue this work. This does require a lot of resources and expertise that comes from the department as well as our external partners, but it's well worth it for us to be able to better focus our resources and improve our response. really the MSS data ultimately tells us something that we were, we can now count that we knew we couldn't really count before. We had a lot of anecdotal information, but we now know with the data that it is actually happening. And the more robust the data is that we get from various school districts, the better we can allocate our resources statewide. And we know that even though not every youth is going to show up in the MSS data, it gives us an opportunity to pair this data with other data we have from law enforcement, from our own service agencies, and from child welfare to create a bigger picture of what trafficking and exploitation of youth looks like in our state. It also allows us the opportunity to look at outcomes from our program and also to create continuous improvement. One of the things we can do in response to this data is to identify and strengthen protective factors for youth. We have a partnership with Love 146, which is an international organization responding to the needs of trafficked and exploited youth. They have a curriculum called Not a Number, and we have been able to partner in this state to train facilitators and get professionals certified in order to deliver this particular curriculum. It's available to youth ages 12 to 18, all gender identities. It's an empowering program for them. Anne Lafreniere Ritchie, who will be testifying in just a moment, is one of the trainers in this program, and she can tell you a lot more about it. But since we have been able to implement it in the state, we have over 1,600 youth who complete the program, and they really do enjoy it and get a lot out of it. Also through MDH, we have youth outreach materials that are available on our website, and they can be downloaded. These are materials that were developed by youth for youth. And then just in the past week and a half, the Office for Victims of Crime in the United States Department of Justice has put out a variety of graphic novels. There's a picture from one of them below that are aimed toward youth victims and witnesses to help explain the criminal justice process in a way that is meaningful to them. We have some tools for adults too. Under our federal grant, MDH was able to create the Minnesota Youth Trafficking and Exploitation Identification Guide, called the MITEI tool. It's available through our website. It's meant really for people who are not working with sexually exploited youth on a regular basis, but might encounter them. It helps them to identify their needs, respond, and actually make referrals to our safe harbor services and other appropriate services in the community. It contains an indicator list that professionals can work through. It has a about 45-minute training that goes along with it so that people can be better prepared to use the tool. In addition, we have a healthcare training coming soon. It's going to be available online. It's for anybody in the healthcare profession, emergency rooms, community clinics. We think it will be particularly useful for school nurses, counselors, teen clinics. And then also, I'd like to point you toward the NetSmarts program, which comes out of the National Center on Missing and Exploited Children. The Bureau of Criminal Apprehension partners on training to teach youth and parents and caregivers how to be safer online, which we know is a place where exploitation is particularly rampant. And then finally, we have some community coordination to provide help. We have the Youth Services Network, which is primarily in the metro area. It's a variety of youth serving organizations. Many safe harbor programs are part of it. I know they will be coming to the legislature this session to talk about all the different ways they work with communities in order to support youth and the different resources that they need. And then the Day One Emergency Shelter and Crisis Hotline responds to needs across the state. It's 24/7, and it's a way for case managers and other programs to find shelter and housing and services in a rapid way for youth who are in need. So with that, I will be happy to answer any questions when the time comes. And now you'll be hearing from one of our regional navigators, Anne Lafreniere Ritchie. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Moving on to Anne Lafreniere Ritchie, a regional navigator for West Central Minnesota. If you could officially introduce yourself for the record and then proceed with your testimony.
Absolutely. My name is Annie Lafreniere Ritchie, and I work for Someplace Safe as a Safe Harbor regional navigator. So I was asked, as you know, by MDH to share more information with you all about the work that regional navigators do with schools and to share more information about Not a Number, which is a trafficking prevention curriculum. I am a Safe Harbor regional navigator out of Someplace Safe in West Central Minnesota. Someplace Safe has served victims of crime in West Central Minnesota since 1979 through a variety of programs and across nine counties. My organization has held the Navigator Grant since 2017 and has received Safe Harbor Supportive Services funding since the inception of the program. The Navigator position covers seven additional counties outside of the Someplace Safe service area, and we partner with other Safe Harbor grantee programs in these communities. So the Minnesota Safe Harbor Network includes strong collaboration and regular connection between the regional navigators and supportive service providers. Navigators meet regularly to check in, share information and resources, and consult on difficult case dynamics. These relationships are incredibly important for continuity of services for clients, but also for sharing tips and tools on overcoming barriers and connecting with community partners, including schools. Navigators often collaborate on regional, statewide, and national trainings to share unique perspectives and areas of expertise. And one such collaboration is actually occurring tomorrow with the Minnesota Association of Alternative Programs annual conference, where my fellow navigator, Kate LePage, and I will be sharing information with alternative school programs about trafficking and exploitation in schools and resources with attendees, including details on the Not a Number curriculum. I've served as a regional navigator in three organizations in two states and was trained as a Not a Number facilitator in 2017 while working as a Safe Harbor navigator in northeastern Minnesota. Janine Thompson, my organization's regional youth advocate, was also trained as a facilitator at the same time. In our roles, both Janine and I have provided the Not a Number prevention curriculum for youth in a variety of settings, including public and private schools. Someplace Safe has partnerships with various local schools, which have allowed us to come in and provide prevention education through one-time presentations and through facilitating Not a Number with students. This education is provided for primary and secondary school students, and my organization helps facilitate an educational summer camp with one local school district. In addition to facilitating the group with youth, I recently received, as Caroline mentioned, training to now train facilitators with Not a Number, thus extending the reach of this crucial curriculum for youth in our state. Someplace Safe's Safe Harbor outreach includes building collaborative partnerships with our local schools because we recognize that much of the time school staff are seeing our youth longer and more consistently than any other adults in their lives. Because of this, schools are in a unique position where they can both identify and refer exploited and high-risk youth for services and also provide accurate and appropriate prevention materials. When we provide ongoing outreach and education to students and schools, we receive requests for services both from school staff and directly from students who are impacted by exploitation. In my own experience implementing this curriculum, I have received various types of self-disclosures of abuse from youth in every single session. What this means is that through the Not a Number curriculum, we're creating spaces where youth can better understand the types of harm that they have experienced and also feel safe enough to share these experiences with a trusted adult. While these disclosures aren't always experiences of trafficking or exploitation, they have included teen dating violence, homelessness, sexual abuse, and suicidal thoughts, and being able to connect these youth with critical resources has, in some cases, been life-saving. The Minnesota Student Survey data shows that that youth in all regions of the state experience exploitation, and agency-specific data shows that we have provided crucial services to exploited and trafficked youth in every single one of the communities my agency serves in rural West Central Minnesota. We also see that not only does this curriculum help youth understand and process their own experiences, it also gives them the skills to treat their peers in a more empathetic way. It challenges negative perceptions about people who have been harmed, and it helps youth think more critically about the things they see and hear on social media. Some people believe that it is important for youth to learn about relationships from their parents or caregivers, but youth are inundated with misinformation, not only from their peers, but sources online such as TikTok and Instagram. Furthermore, Department of Human Services data shows that many youth who are exploited in Minnesota are actually exploited by a parent, caregiver, or family member. Providing this curriculum to youth allows for them to receive accurate education on healthy relationships, vulnerabilities as they relate to exploitation and trafficking, and ways to keep themselves safe and healthy through resources available in their own communities. In addition to the benefits I've already spoken on, Another positive about Not a Number is that not only does it provide youth with important information on exploitation, risks, and their safety, the curriculum also has a caregiver training that educates parents and caregivers on exploitation and trafficking of young people. In coordination with youth curriculum, entire communities are positively impacted by the information shared through Not a Number. Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to speak on behalf of the curriculum and then also our targeted outreach to youth. And I hope that you're better able to understand the importance and impact this education has for our youth.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Next on the agenda, we have Megan Lundberg. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Megan Lundberg. I serve as a survivor consultant and also work at an agency called YouthWorks as a survivor leader advisor. So again, my name is Megan Lundberg. I'm a licensed social worker as well as a survivor of human trafficking. I've worked with runaway, homeless, and trafficked youth for going on 8 years now. I provide consultation and technical assistance from the lens of both a survivor as well as a professional in this field. I have provided national training with the National Network for Youth and the McCain Institute, testified at legislation in other states, and am certified in multiple curriculums dedicated to educating our youth on exploitation. The past several years, I have been facilitating a group called My Life, My Choice. My Life, My Choice is an evidence-based prevention group for females ages 12 to 17 years old. This curriculum consists of 10 sessions addressing healthy relationships, substance abuse, sexual health, community resources, self-esteem, and how youth can identify sexual exploitation. Ideally, participating in this group, it will assist them with the shift of knowledge, attitudes, and behaviors surrounding this issue. In my time facilitating this group, I have discovered a shocking truth. Of the girls referred to a prevention group, more than half have already experienced exploitation. The average age of participants in this group is around 14 years old. So at 14 years old, we're reaching them too late. The best way to combat human trafficking is to give youth access to the information. We cannot expect that children know what they don't know. The importance of helping youth understand what exploitation is imperative in the prevention. The trauma of exploitation is complex and it's never truly undone. Reactionary work requires wraparound resources for the lifetime of that individual. Prevention work allows resources to be allocated before the victimization occurs. My first experience of exploitation happened in high school and continued into young adulthood in Minnesota and North Dakota. Do I know if my life would have been different had I had access to this knowledge as a young person? I can't say for certain. However, I do think I would have felt differently about what happened to me. Understanding exploitation and the how it happens can assist in combating the shame and blame that comes with being a victim. However, it is important that those providing education to the youth are educated messengers. It is crucial those providing the education have extensive training on exploitation, how to handle disclosures, and what to do with that information. A disclosure of exploitation is sacred, with the youth expressing something most vulnerable. The individual on the receiving end of this information truly impacts the next direction the youth may take, including interaction with service providers and law enforcement. I believe these are all necessary factors in addressing the problem that is exploitation. There are many evidence-based curriculums that help youth understand exploitation. What's most important isn't whether that curriculum is Not a Number or My Life, My Choice. What is most important is that we try to educate our young people. I encourage you to pass this bill in an effort to change our youth and their future. It took me many years to find my voice, and though today I'm able to use my victimization for greater change, they are experiences that no one should have to have or experience. This is an opportunity to be a catalyst of change in the lives of our youth, and it would be a shame not to take it. Thank you for your time this afternoon and enjoy your day. Also, questions are great.
Thank you so much for your testimony and for sharing something so personal with us today. Finally, we have Gloria Perez with the Women's Foundation. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Richardson, Lead Erickson, and members of the committee. My name is Gloria Perez, and I am President and CEO of the Women's Foundation of Minnesota. I really appreciate the opportunity to testify on this important and concerning issue facing high school students across the state of Minnesota. For 38 years, the Women's Foundation has invested more than $32 million in community investments across the state and advanced policy to create a state where women, girls, and their families thrive. With the Center on Women, Gender, and Public Policy at the Humphrey School, we produce the state's leading research on the well-being of women and girls. Funding this research highlights why the Women's Foundation works upstream to change systems with young women in Minnesota, beginning with those most impacted by exploitation and violence. We listen to those who are impacted most to create solutions. Our commitment to systems change that centers communities extends from our historic investments in Minnesota Girls Are Not For Sale to the Young Women's Initiative of Minnesota and investments in research and policy change today. As part of the Minnesota Girls Are Not For Sale effort, we were proud to work in partnership across the state to promote the passage of Safe Harbor Act, which has been explained in full detail today. But what we love is that it is a collective impact model that is really able to demonstrate real outcomes for our youth and families. And as this report indicates, there's more to be done to prevent sexual exploitation and abuse. More than 5,000 students reported trading sex for food, shelter, funds, or other needs. A truly striking thought when those students should only have to worry about studying for a test or being ready for band practice. As we see from the disaggregated data in this report, students disproportionately affected by sexual exploitation represent intersections of race, gender, place, and additional identities. The data shows us where we must invest in community-led solutions, including in our juvenile correction facilities, foster care system, and at school. This report shows us the added vulnerabilities we know our trans and gender expansive youth face in Minnesota. We also see the disparate impact faced by our Native youth in this report, and we cannot look away. The youth who answered yes to this question on the survey have value and they have a future. We must do all we can to make their stories visible and protect their safety so that they can see Minnesota as a place where they can pursue their potential, continue their education, and contribute to our state. The results of this study demand that we invest in comprehensive safety and healing so that women, girls, and all people are free from all forms of violence and can experience their homes, schools, and communities as safe places. And we support making additional investments in Safe Harbor and No Wrong Door across the state to support survivors and prevent trafficking. Sexual exploitation has no place in Minnesota, particularly in our schools. By providing safe, accessible, and culturally responsive options, we can prevent this abuse. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you so much for your testimony. We have several individuals who are also on deck and available for questions as well. And we have a number of members who have hands up, so we'll jump right in. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you to everyone who spoke today about this very difficult subject. I really want to thank you for sharing personal stories and stories of others that I know are close to you. I have some questions, and I'm not, and it sounds like anyone would be a fine person to answer these questions. But I thought of these questions when Dr. Martin and Dr. Ryder were speaking, but I was wondering about what are some of the most common reasons that students are trading sex or are being exploited, and how can schools provide remedies for this? So I was thinking, is it hunger? Do schools need to provide more school meals? Do we need more instruction on sexual violence? Do we need a better affirmation and education for students on diverse gender identities? Do we need addiction services? Do we need to provide housing? What are some of the most common reasons that students, so I guess to sum it up, what are some of the most common reasons that students are being exploited in this manner? And how can schools directly disrupt that exploitation?
Dr. Martin or Dr. Ryder, which one of you would like to begin?
I can start, but I know that other presenters here will also have really deep content knowledge on this as well. I think from the perspective of the Minnesota Student Survey data, that data doesn't give us causality. It tells us about correlations. So it shows things that kind of hang together, but it doesn't tell us what came first. I will say other research that I've conducted over the last 17 years really points to some pretty key factors around what's behind some of this. And some of the things you mentioned are for sure part of that, you know, lack of stable housing, not having enough to eat, just those basic needs, that sort of lack of basic support systems for young people. It's a push factor into involvement in trading sex. I think some of the correlations that we're seeing in the Minnesota Student Survey around bullying and harassment, around gender identity, around racial and ethnic identity. And I wanna be super clear here, those identities are not what causes people to trade sex. It's the harassment, bullying, and harm, the systemic pieces around how people of different identities are treated that I think drives, you know, could be looked at as a root cause. You know, when we think about the labor market and employment and who has access to resources, we see pretty big disparities there. So I think all of the things that you kind of brought up, Representative Jordan, are part of the picture. I think schools play a huge role in promoting protective factors that can help prevent young people from really having to trade sex for basic, you know, for things that young people should just have by virtue of being human. So it's challenging. I would like for some other of the presenters to be able to jump in as well, because I know there's other thoughts, but I don't know.
Oh, Dr. Martin, we've got several hands up, so I think we'll probably leave it there for the moment. Representative Jordan, any follow-up?
I mean, I would love to hear this, but I'm really touched by something that Ms. Lundberg said, where she said the best way to combat exploitation is to provide that knowledge. And so I'm hoping we can hear a little bit more about ways for us to provide that knowledge and some of those services that schools need to provide for students. The other number that is just really in my mind is the high percentage of students that, despite feeling anxious or scared or seeking questions about their gender identity, a lot of our students do feel safe at schools. And so I do think it's important that in this committee, we're examining how we can continue to provide those services that students need at a safe place, but also to make other spaces in their lives safe. So I'm really grateful again, Madam Chair, and anxious to hear more.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. Representative Drazkowski.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Dr. Martin as well. Dr. Martin, not all of us are fully apprised of or aware of some of these deviant sexual behaviors. I don't know what cisgender is. Can you explain what that is?
Dr. Martin.
Certainly. And I guess I would say that, first of all, I'm not sure that we would describe these as deviant sexual behaviors. So I'm not sure with sex trading, we really are looking at that as something that young people do to get what they need to survive. So I wouldn't put that word on it. Cisgender is gender that is aligned with your sex assigned at birth. If that makes sense.
Representative Drazkowski, any follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Dr. Martin. I'm not fully following, but I did see the number 1.4%, and I was thinking, oh, it'd be kind of interesting to see that in, you know, in kind of a long list of all of the things that are threats to our kids, suicide, for instance. It'd be good to see kind of perspective around some of the other threats that they face and where this fits in. But with the 1.4%, Doctor, if you took those other sexual behaviors that are not normal, you don't want to call them deviant, but the dictionary says that's pretty accurate. If you took that population and normalize them, or if they were in an area that wasn't cisgender or wasn't transgender, and they had sexual behaviors instead that were the same as the regular category, whatever that category was called, where would that 1.4% number go?
Dr. Martin?
Yeah, I'm not 100%. I think I understand a little bit what you're asking. So I'll try to, are you trying to understand how this issue of sex trading fits within the broader issues of things that young people might be experiencing in schools? Is that one of your questions?
No, doctor, I'm so 1.4%. So if you took an extrapolated, I can't remember the percentage, it was like 50% or something like that, in people who are not cisgender and who are not transgender that trade sex in school. But if you're cisgender or transgender, you were up much higher. It was a much higher rate. If those, like I like to call deviant sexual behaviors, were not deviant and were in the other population, where would that 1% over the entire group of kids go? Obviously, it's going to go down. What percent would that, if you extrapolated that, the other group to the cisgender and transgender group, what would the overall percentage change to?
Right. So I don't know. I would invite Nick if you have thoughts on the statistics behind this, but basically 1.4% includes all youth who said yes to that question. So when we're doing the intersectional breakdown, that table is showing you the first on the, it starts with all youth, and then we start to look at differences within the different groups of how young people identify. So a big piece of this is really about young people expressing how they identify, and then looking at this issue and how it's intersected with those, with how young people self-identify. Nick, do you want to add anything?
Dr. Ryder, I'll give you the opportunity to have the last word, but we have several other hands, and so then we'll move on after this. Dr. Ryder?
I think what Dr. Martin said at the end was really what it was. So the 1.4% is the number of people who reported trading sex. So that is that more like, I think, the number that you're looking for. So I think there's also a terminology like confusion that's happening. So when we're looking at gender in this kind of more high level analysis that we've done, the first level of breaking down the group by gender was cisgender or transgender. So there isn't another category there. And then we divide within the transgender group and within the cisgender group. So when you're asking for like, what is the number, if we were thinking about everyone, it is that 1.4% across Minnesota.
So, Madam Chair, if I just could quickly, and thank you, Doctor, but so maybe now I understand cisgender is kind of the normal behavior that most people do, and then, so it was cisgender and transgender. I guess I got to learn what cisgender means.
We're going to move on, Representative Drazkowski. We've got several other hands and only a few minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just wondering what we need to do in terms of public policy to help.
Representative Wasilewicz, you have the floor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I noted in sort of the discussion, especially in the beginning with the University of Minnesota folks, some of the populations that had higher rates, juvenile correctional facilities, alternative learning centers. I wonder if there's any research on sort of a lot of those things align with ACEs, and I'm wondering if you've encountered any research that looks at the prevalence of sex trading with like the range of ACEs scores that youth might have, if there's any information out there on that.
And I apologize, Representative Wasilewicz, was that directed at someone?
I saw several people nodding, so really whoever can maybe answer that question, whether that's someone from the university or MDH.
Well, I see Carolyn Palmer has unmuted. Please proceed.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. That's a great question. Absolutely, the ACEs play a very big part in the consideration as we look at this work. At MDH, we are very actively involved with grants and projects that look at ACEs in a various contexts. And so in terms of our safe harbor work, we are very often even kind of looking at mapping ACEs data along with the data that we have from safe harbor and from other resources. It's something we're actually looking at a bit more closely. So thank you for bringing that up. It's a really important part of the discussion.
Thank you. Any follow-up, Representative Wasilek?
No, I would just ask if there is any, you know, research that's already out there. I would love to see some of that or have a link to some of that. If it's an ongoing thing, then, I'm willing to wait for it. But if there is anything already that's been done, I would love to see that research.
Yes, Madam Chair and Representative, that is information that we could provide to you.
Thank you. We can ensure that that gets out to the entire committee. I see Representative Erdahl next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this question is directed to Ms. Lafreniere-Ritchie. She talked about curriculum quite a bit, and I am wondering to whom is the curriculum imparted? Is it one-on-one? Is it to a class, to a small group? Is this to be done in schools, or what is the setting? How is the curriculum imparted?
That's a really great question. So it is done in group settings. It can be done with small groups, and it can be done in entire classrooms. Ideally, anywhere between 8 and 30 youth it's appropriate for. So school classrooms, totally appropriate. After school groups, totally appropriate. And it's for both males and females.
Representative Erdahl, any follow-up?
No, just thank you. Answers my question.
Thank you. Moving on, Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I had a couple questions, and the first one was, I think I know the answer to this, but I don't think the survey asks who is doing the exploiting, if it's an adult, if it's a juvenile, and I'm seeing some heads nodding to that. Do we have any information outside of the survey as to who are the ones that are most commonly doing this kind of exploitation?
Dr. Ryder, I saw you shaking your head. I don't know if you have any more to add to that, or perhaps Carolyn Palmer.
Specific to the MSS, there isn't an additional question that asks what you were saying, like who's doing the exploiting or anything like that. Specific to the MSS, the question that we presented is the question that we have. I'm not sure about some of the other efforts that are around the MSS, and so I don't want to misspeak on that if someone from MDH does want to jump in there, if that's okay.
Carolyn Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Exploitation can come from a variety of sources. It could be from somebody who is in a family. It could be somebody who is a community leader or somebody that they have contact through the community. It could be somebody who presents themselves as a boyfriend or girlfriend to somebody. It could be friends. It can come online through people who are claiming to be one person and be somebody else. It's in a variety of different settings that youth encounter this. I'm wondering if maybe Anna Fournier-Ritchie or Megan Lundberg can give a little more detail on that.
Looking to see if either one.
I couldn't find my unmute. In my experience, we see predominantly peer-to-peer exploitation, so youth exploiting other youth, and whether that's for substances or food or places to stay seem to be the most common. And then I would say the other common one I see is familial exploitation. So a family member that is then trafficking that young person.
Representative Mueller, follow up.
Yeah, thank you. And I guess that was another question I had too, because I know the school survey asks about other forms of sexual violence and relationship violence. And so I was curious how the question you looked at today, the prevalence with some of those other sexual violence and relationship violence questions, and I don't need to get an answer today, but I'm interested in that, if that's something that you can provide us. And then the other thing I would just wonder is if there are resources that are provided to youth when they take this, because there are a lot of very difficult questions on here. And so what kind of supports provided to students after they've taken this survey?
Dr. Ryder or Martin, would you be able to answer the question of any follow-up to the students? Or would MDH have guidance? Dr. Ryder, I've seen you, that you've unmuted.
Go ahead. I thought it was.
I was gonna say, I know that different school districts who do participate and their students participate do put in different supports, and different districts kind of approach it differently. So I know that I'm blanking on the name right now, but there is one school district who actually have like social workers that are the ones helping with administrating the survey and are willing to like answer questions or provide additional resources. And so I think it's set up in different ways across different districts. And so.
Thank you. We have several hands raised. I think we're gonna move on, Representative Mueller. And Representative Erickson, I see you next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the presenters, you know, we passed Aaron's Law in 2017. Do you have any knowledge as to what extent that abuse of children protection is being used in our school system? You know, across the board, because Aaron's Law has aspects of it that can be taught at a very early age to alert children to abuse. You know, if we're going to consider this exploitation abuse, do we have any knowledge of how Aaron's Law is playing out?
Carolyn Palmer, I see you're unmuted, so I'm assuming that you may have a comment.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Erickson. I don't have a whole lot of information. I am very familiar with Aaron's Law and when it was passed. It's an important opportunity for schools to bring in more child sexual abuse education. Unfortunately, we don't have information at the Department of Health about how often it's being used, but perhaps the Department of Education would be able to provide that. I know that they were required to put up information about sexual abuse curriculum and opportunities to educate.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will check with MDE to see to what extent it's used, because that was important legislation that we passed. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll pause for a quick moment to see if there's a representative from MDE that might have information now. Or we can also get that after the meeting as well if we're not seeing anyone. Okay, Representative Edelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Ryder, or I'm sorry, I can't see the other presenter. Zoom is always trying to find the person. Wondering, I was concerned with the 12% and the 5.4%. It looks like juvenile correctional facilities, kids that are either end up there or also in alternative learning centers, are really highly targeted or end up being victims. I guess I'm wondering, do you know if, say, in the JDC, if there's good trauma-centered, really tailored curriculum that's helping them? And what are we doing? I mean, obviously, I mean, that's a huge jump from just other, I mean, again, maybe the data depends on who's reporting, but it's really concerning to me as somebody that works on juvenile issues. So if you could give us a little bit of what you know about that.
And I think the department might have more to say around that. So I will go to MDH, Carolyn Palmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Edelson. Actually, we did have an opportunity through a grant from the Office of Justice Programs and the Minnesota Department of Public Safety to bring the Not a Number curriculum to, I think it was over 20 juvenile facilities in the state. That was an excellent opportunity to train folks who are working within the system to administer that training, and also to get them more familiar with Safe Harbor. And so if it's helpful, we can follow up with the Department of Corrections to see how that's being used now.
Representative Adelson, any follow-up?
No, thank you, Madam Chair. I would be very appreciative of that. That would be great. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll be brief. It is incorrect that having a different gender identity or identifying as transgender is deviant. It is a normal and perfectly acceptable thing for anyone to identify as, and implying that transgender children or children that have been victims of sexual exploitation are deviant or somehow abhorrent is actually abhorrent. I think that is important for us to say in this meeting. And for any members of the public, that is not true, what has been implied. And we need to make sure that we are actually attacking this any sort of bigotry and shame that would prevent students from feeling comfortable going forward and learning about how to avoid being exploited or learn more about what will make them a happy and healthy adult. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Jordan. I will note that there is going to be more data that will be coming out, if I'm remembering the timeline correctly, I believe maybe around this fall, there would be more data on this subject. And so we are definitely looking forward to seeing the data and also understanding if the impact of the pandemic has shifted the data in any way as well. I want to take this opportunity to thank all of our testifiers today. I especially want to take this opportunity to thank those who came forward with their very personal stories as well. We know that this is a traumatic topic. We know that it is a painful topic, and we know that it takes a lot of courage to come forward. But by coming forward, it's an opportunity to be able to help and support other students and other individuals who are survivors as well. One note that I wanted to leave the committee with. We didn't have an opportunity to see all of the different ways that the university has been able to lay out some of the data, including data looking at students who have experienced this form of victimization and their hopes and dreams for the future. Because even with the difficult experiences that many of these students have had, the trauma that they have experienced, there's a real hope within the data in terms of what they want for their future, what they want in terms of their education, and what they want in terms of their career. No one is defined by the worst thing that has happened to them. And I just want to leave the members with that thought. Thank you again for everyone who participated today. And we look forward to receiving the additional information that has been identified. And with that, we'll stand adjourned. Have a great afternoon, everyone.